From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
There's bad news and good news, I guess. The bad news is, by my count, we have 1,358 more days of the Bush presidency. The good news is tomorrow we'll have 1,357.
Today, an hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh in speech and conversation.
Rumsfeld tells the president in January about an incident with photographs that, if it becomes public, will destroy, certainly cut into much of what they're doing, will be a significant, absolute catastrophic blow to their policy of winning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. At this time, the pretense is still the resistance can be overcome, or the insurgency. And what does the president do? Nothing. That's the critical thing.
Today, Seymour Hersh in studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. More than 60 people were killed early this morning in a series of suicide bombings across Iraq. The largest number of deaths happened in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, where more than 30 were killed as a car bomb detonated near a crowded market. Just north of the city, another bomber killed 30 more people in an attack on an army recruiting center. Meanwhile, Iraqi officials say a resistance group kidnapped the governor of the western Sunni province of Al-Anbar, where U.S. forces are carrying out what they call Operation Matador, one of the largest post-Saddam military operations in Iraq. The U.S. admits it's facing fierce resistance. Over the past several days, at least 14 U.S. troops have been killed in fighting in the west of the country, many of them in guerrilla-style ambushes or urban combat. On Capitol Hill, Congress officially approved more than $80 billion in additional funding for the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, boosting the cost of the U.S. war on terror to more than $300 billion since 2001. The Senate approved the measure by a unanimous vote. The House approved the measure last week and now goes to President Bush for his signature, which is virtually guaranteed. The legislation represents the fifth such emergency spending package Congress has taken up since 2001. It also includes sweeping immigration charges, changes, a nearly tenfold increase in the one-time payment for families of troops killed in combat, and money to build the largest embassy in the world in Iraq. But most of the money, more than $70 billion, goes to the military. Attached to the spending bill was a highly controversial provision on national identification cards. Critics blasted the Republicans for tagging it onto the bill, saying it's unconstitutional and anti-immigrant. The measure requires states to start issuing more uniform driver's licenses and verify the citizenship or legal status of people getting them. It also toughens asylum laws, authorizes the completion of a fence across the California-Mexican border, and provides money to hire more border security agents. Critics charge the legislation also encourages bounty hunters to hunt undocumented immigrants and makes asylum seekers get proof that their own government, from their own government, that they're being persecuted. Groups opposing the bill run the gamut of the political spectrum, from the ACLU to Gun Owners of America. Court-martial proceedings begin today against two U.S. soldiers who refused to fight in Iraq. Navy sailor Pablo Paredes will appear in a military court in San Diego, while Army soldier Kevin Benderman appears before a tribunal in Fort Stewart, Georgia. Yesterday was a National Day of Action in support of conscientious objectors and war resistors and against military recruitment in schools. Both men face up to a year in prison. A U.S. court has thrown out a lawsuit against Vice President Dick Cheney. The suit sought details about Vice President Dick Cheney's 2001 Energy Policy Task Force that formed policy favorable to the industry. The unanimous ruling ordered a federal judge to dismiss the lawsuit by the Sierra Club Environmental Group and the watchdog Judicial Watch. The dismissal of the case had been expected after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in June last year that refused to require that task force records be disclosed. It has sent the case back to the appeals court. Meanwhile, in other Dick Cheney-related news, the U.S. Army said Tuesday it's awarded $72 million in bonuses to Halliburton for logistics work in Iraq. The Army said its so-called award fee board in Iraq had met in March and had agreed to pay Halliburton unit Kellogg Brown and Root bonuses for work it did in support of U.S. forces there. Halliburton was run by Vice President Dick Cheney until he joined the 2000 race for the White House. The company has raked in well over $7 billion under its 2001 logistics contract with the U.S. military. King Abdullah of Jordan has agreed to pardon Iraqi politician and one-time CIA asset Ahmed Chalabi. For years, Chalabi's faced a 22-year prison sentence in Jordan for fraud after his Petra Bank collapsed in 1989 with more than $300 million in missing deposits. Iraqi President Jalal Talabani asked the king to resolve the differences between Jordan and Chalabi during a visit to Amman this week. In Brazil, South American and Arab leaders are holding an historic summit aimed not so subtly at reducing U.S. power globally. Officially, the summit is addressing economic issues, but has moved quickly into some of the most pressing international conflicts. Yesterday, the gathering criticized the world's richest countries and Israel and gave support to the Palestinians. In a statement, the two regions demand that Israel disband settlements in Palestinian areas, including, quote, those in East Jerusalem, and retreat to its borders before the 67 war. They also blasted U.S. economic sanctions against Syria and denounced terrorism. But they assert the right of people, quote, to resist foreign occupation in accordance with the principles of international legality and in compliance with international humanitarian law. At the summit in Brasilia, there are some 9,000 soldiers, 16 heads of state, and top officials from 34 South American, Middle Eastern, and North African countries. Now to Afghanistan, where a spokesperson for Taliban leader Mullah Mohammed Omar says the cleric would reject any offer of amnesty from the Afghan government. This comes in response to the head of Afghanistan's Reconciliation Commission calling for Mullah Omar and other senior Taliban leaders to be included in a broader amnesty. The Taliban spokesperson said, on Omar's orders, resistance fighters have increased attacks on U.S. forces in recent weeks and will continue these attacks. Meanwhile, Afghan officials say at least four people have been killed and many injured after police opened fire on an anti-U.S. protest in the east of the country. Hundreds of students rioted in the city of Jalalabad over reports that the Quran was desecrated at the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In labor news, United Airlines last night won its bid to end its four-employee pension plans, clearing the way for what's being called the largest pension default in corporate history. The airline's unions denounced the decision by a federal bankruptcy court and vowed they could go on strike against United over the move. Airline industry analysts predict this could spark a chain reaction among other airlines. The four pension plans cover more than 120,000 employees and retirees. Now to the ongoing battle over John Bolton, President Bush's nominee for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. In an interview with the Associated Press yesterday, Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee said he would now support Bolton. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is set to vote Thursday on his nomination. Chafee said he decided to support Bolton because he is President Bush's choice. Chafee said, quote, I won't deny a lot of the information certainly brings great pause, but I fight the administration on so many issues. This is one of those that I've been with them on to appoint their team. A 10-8 party line vote on the Republican-led panel would send Bolton's nomination to the full Senate, where he's likely to be confirmed. Democrats say they don't plan to try to delay the vote. And in sports news, the NBA has named Steve Nash of the Phoenix Suns the league's most valuable player, edging out the Miami Heat's Shaquille O'Neal. Nash has spoken out publicly against the occupation of Iraq. At the 2003 All-Star Game, Nash wore a T-shirt that read, "Shoot baskets, not people." When questioned about the shirt, Nash said, quote, "I think that war is wrong in 99.9% of all cases." He went on to say that the invasion of Iraq, quote, "is more about oil than it is about nuclear weapons."
Of false information, all barriers to true emancipation. It's scarier when you're aware how they're connected to corporations. It's the media causing mass hysteria in all areas.
The Media by Welfare Poets here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the PBS and NPR studios here in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, at the University of Illinois, WILL and WILL-TV. Urbana is a hub of independent media activity. The local independent media center here is one of the most active in the country and has just bought the post office. Yep, you got it right. Just bought the post office. Talking about sending a message. In a few weeks, the low-power FM station, WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, will begin broadcasting from there. And the city's working on offering free wireless internet broadband access. Meanwhile, community radio station WEFT is going strong, as is public access TV Channel 6. Well, this week, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is hosting a conference focusing on the state of the media in this country. It's called Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? The conference is the first of its kind. It's sponsored by the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research. It was established last fall by the College of Communications. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker magazine delivered the keynote address last night. Hersh won the prize for exposing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Last year, he broke the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal. He's author of the book Chain of Command, From 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He broke the prisoner abuse story a year ago. This is an excerpt of what he had to say last night about My Lai and Abu Ghraib.
So in My Lai, the kids go into a village where they're going to allegedly, they've lost about 15 or 20% of their people. They've come into the country in December 67. 100 guys, Lieutenant Calley's one of the platoon leaders, but he's a fanciful figure. There were many officers involved, but the world has stuck it on him. Okay, but Calley was one of their officers, and they're told they're going to meet the enemy finally after losing, as I say, 15 guys to bombs, landmines, and sniper fire. So they go in. The next day, there's nobody there, women and children. They kill 550 or 540 or 530. The numbers sort of differ, but they're that high. Three groups, they shoot in the ditches, mostly farm boy shooting. Some of the Hispanic and black guys told me they shot, but up in the air. It's just, they didn't dare not shoot. This is a war where a lot of bullets in the back. Unlike it's in Vietnam, it's better now. It was a lot of bullets in the back if you didn't go along. And they shot up in the air. This doesn't mean that the Hispanics or the African Americans fought the war at any level better, but in this case they did. And so the next day, one of the kids who did most of the shooting, a kid named Midlo, gets his foot blown off. They're patrolling somewhere near My Lai 4, and he screams one of these oaths that everybody remembered. I was doing this story, in 69 and 70. Talked to 55 of the kids there. Sad saps. Ended up thinking they were as much victims, in a sense, as the people they shot. Which wasn't the way you start out. You're mad at them. It's hard to stay mad at them because of what it's, anyway. So they're taking away Midlo, and he's screaming, "God has punished me, Calley, Lieutenant Calley, and he's gonna punish you too." Calley was the one who ordered him to shoot in the ditch, and he shot 10 or 15 clips. And so I'm looking for him, and I'm doing the stories as a freelancer. And I'm looking for him. I'm somewhere in the West Coast, and I hear about Midlo, and I find his phone. Somebody tells me, one of the kids I'm talking to in the unit, somewhere in Indiana, we didn't have Google, it was a lot harder then. Find his house. He's Southern Indiana, farm boy. I get down there the next day. I fly overnight to, I think, it's Indianapolis, below Terre Haute, a place called New Goshen, down in the southern part of Indiana. Chicken farm, I pull in, it's a chicken farm out of Norman Rockwell, one of those old paintings from the Saturday Evening Post. It's poor, just chicken coops, no farmland, a bunch of shacks, that's the home. The mother that I talked to the night before, I said, I'm coming. She said, I can't tell you he's going to talk to her. I said, I'm coming and you decide. She said, just come, but I can't promise. She comes out to meet me. She's 50 maybe, weathered, no man around, looks 70. And I just say, is Paul Meadlow in there? Is he around? She said, he's in there. I said, is it all right if I talk to him? She said, okay. And then she says, quote unquote, she says, I gave them a good boy and they sent me back a murderer. Okay, flash forward 35 years. I'm doing Abu Ghraib. I did a bunch of stories in a row for the New Yorker. I'm going right after Rummy right away because there's no way, you know, as somebody who had consumed the Human Rights Watches and Amnesty reports, I knew that systematically this kind of abuse was going on all the time, how to get at it. I've been told by Iraqis in the Middle East that I talked to about Abu Ghraib 6 months earlier, that the prison was so bad that the women in the prisons were sending messages home to their brothers and fathers to please come kill them because they've been defiled in prison by the Americans. I mean, I knew that, but how do you get to that story? You know, it's just impossible to get to that story. The photographs made it work. So I'm doing this stuff. I get a call in the middle of these stories. And does everybody know? Of course everybody knows what's going on. Are you kidding? The timeline, the chronology, I told you. What does the president not do? He doesn't do anything. He doesn't take any steps at all confronted with Abu Ghraib. Not one step to change anything. They just hope they can get away with a couple of low-level court martials as they did with Cali. They did, but they could have. Anyway, it was a rational chance, rational gamble. So in the middle of this stuff, I get a call from a mother. She wants to see me somewhere in northeastern America. I go see her. There's a kid that was in the unit, the 372nd. They'd all come home early, if you remember the timeline. They did their stuff in late 2003, reported in 2004. This mother's telling me, I'm writing in the spring of 2004. In March of 2004, the kid had come home in the same unit. Totally changed. Young, pretty woman, vibrant, depressed, disconsolate, inconsolable, isolated, had been newly married, left her husband, left the family, moved to a nearby town, working a night job or whatever. And nobody could figure out what's going on. She sees the stories about Abu Ghraib. She goes, knocks on the door, shows the young woman the newspaper, and door slams, bam. And at that point, as she tells me later, as she tells me in real time, this is May, early May, she goes back, the kid had been given a computer, a portable computer. Like, it turns out all the GIs in Iraq and all over the world now, portable computers are great because you have CD drives and you put a movie in there and then you're in business. And so you can watch movies and play games on your dead time. I hadn't thought about it, but that's what happens. That's why all the CD, these digital pictures are being passed around in the unit because everybody has a computer. So she claims, this is not a woman familiar with Freud or the unconscious, she claims at that point she just decided to look at the computer. After hearing about Abu Ghraib, she said she just hadn't looked at it. She just was going to clean it up and take it to her office as a second computer. No thoughts. And she's deleting files, and she sees a file marked Iraq, and she hits it, and out comes 60 or 80 digital photographs of the one that the New Yorker ran of the naked guy standing against the cell in terror, hands behind his back, so he can't protect his private parts, which is the instinct. And two snarling German shepherds. Somebody said they're Belgian shepherds, perhaps, but two snarling shepherds, on each side of him. And the sequence, the dogs attack the man, blood all over. I was later told anecdotally, I could never prove it. I'm telling you stuff that is not provable. I mean, at least that there was an understanding, at least in the prison corps population, that the dogs were specially trained to hit the groin area, which is one of the reasons there was so much fear of the dogs. This is, I will tell you right now, widely believed among many senior officers that I know in the military. But again, it's not demonstrable. There's no way of codifying that. In any case, the fear was palpable in the picture. So she looks at this stuff and eventually calls me, and we do it all, and we get permission. We run the photographs, just one, how much? And the thought there, the editors, was how much to humiliate the Arab world and the Arab man. One is enough. You know, we can describe what else is on the picture. We just don't need more than one. And then later, the mother calls me back and we became friends. This happens a lot to people in my business. You get to like people. And she says, you know, one thing I didn't tell you that was, you have to know about the young woman. When she came back every weekend, she would go and get herself tattooed. And eventually, she said, she was filling her body with large black tattoos. And eventually, they filled up every portion of her skin was tattooed, at least all the portions you could see. And there was no reason to make assumptions about the other portions. She was tattooed completely. It was as if, the mother said, she wanted to change her skin. And so they sent me a boy, and I sent him back a murderer, changing her skin. This war is going to reverberate in ways that we can't even begin to see.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh speaking at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign at a major media reform conference. We'll come back to his remarks, and then he joins us live in the studio here as we broadcast from the University of Illinois. Stay with us. Two More Dead by RJD2 here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from the NPR and PBS studios of University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, WILL and WILL-TV. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the keynote address last night of Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh, his latest book is called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11. To Abu Ghraib.
Prison system is, let's see, since those stories about a year and a month ago, there's been 10 in Pentagon investigations, repeated talks about whether General Sanchez, the leader, could authorize dogs to do this on Tuesday but not on Thursday, and whether or not you could put people's head underwater on Wednesday but not on Friday rules. And everybody I talked to before I did this story, and I knew about Abu Ghraib months before, there was never a suggestion of a rule in terms of how you approach taking care of prisoners. To the young kids, everybody in the prison was a terrorist. To the soldiers, particularly the MPs and some of the Marines who guarded in Guantanamo, and you could do whatever you wanted. You can kill them. That was stupid. That would get you in trouble. It wouldn't be so good to break many bones unless you could claim it was an accident, but you could just do what you wanted, and everybody understood you. And it's only afterwards we generated a lot of rules. We can talk about this more. But anyway, in the paper again today, there's the lead story today in the New York Times. And again, I'm not shocking you when I tell you there's never been an administration in which has deliberately set out to spin the press. We've always had spinning of the press. And as Bob mentioned earlier, that's all part of the game. We've had the horrible tragedy of the Pentagon Papers, which showed that the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, particularly Kennedy and Johnson too, I can't differentiate that much between them, lied and lied and lied and got away with it. You have to understand, it's not that hard inside the government to tell a lie. So this is an administration that has brought that art, the art of lying, not only to the world, not only to foreign reporters, but lying to the American press, systematically misrepresenting and lying. They brought it to a new art form. For example, after the elections, they were interesting elections because if anybody, not to get into dwell too much on it, but what did we vote for? Anybody in Iraq, they were voting not for an assemblyman or a legislator, they were voting sectarianism, sectarian lines. They were voting a religious track. It was an election solely based on religion, ethnicity. That was the issue. And it was the strangest election. You know, you don't need me to tell you. What plays out today shows that the election doesn't work. But anyway, in the paper today is the lead story in the Times, 100 rebels killed in Western Iraq. We're back in the body count, by the way. Sometimes we call them insurgents. The rebels, that's a great word because I'm wacko on this word insurgency. Just so you know, an insurgency suggests you've won the war and there are people who disagree. They're rebels or they're insurgents, as I said. We're still fighting the war. We started, folks. We started a war largely against Sunnis and Baathists, in many cases tribal groups that supported Saddam or were at least frightened enough to support him. We started a war against the people we're still fighting. They gave us Baghdad very quickly. They retreated. They simply are not fighting the war in the way and the manner we want them to, that our press, you know, wants to tell you they did, that the government wants to tell the press, wants to suggest that we won, and then an insurgency broke out again. We're fighting a resistance movement. The irony is, it's a resistance movement that probably, and has been for years, more than a year, trying to find ways to talk to us, and just like, you know, the way we deal with most of this administration deals with the Iranians, or the Syrians, or the North Koreans, and the resistance, you don't talk to them. It's an amazing, this is a government that absolutely says, we won't talk to anybody we disagree with, and gets away with it on a daily level, consistently, no criticism, no suggestion, no pressure to have bilateral talks with people. In any case, so today's paper says 100 rebels, we're getting a body count going again, killed in Western Iraq, and inside the story, it says, they quote some colonel in a telephone interview because, as you, I'm sure, know, the press in Baghdad, this is not their fault. They can't do anything much. They stay behind the green zone, which is pretty much penetrated, too, I believe. So I'm told by the opposition, but, you know, the insurgency or the resistance, what will happen there, God knows. When they choose to do something inside the green zone, they will do it. As a colonel is quoted saying that... they were dying at a, they found some insurgents, they began to attack them, the Marines and others, and they 100 died, and he said, as Marines, we'd rather engage them this way in face-to-face combat and destroy them and kill them. They're dying at a rapid rate. Then in IUDs, you know, shorthand for the car bombs and other explosives that have been killing so many troops. So the suggestion of the story is that 100 rebels or insurgents who normally would be happily going along, blowing up American vehicles. There's the military joke about the Striker. It's called an IED magnet inside in the military. It's a magnet for these bombs. They instead would choose to stupidly stand up and fight us one for one and die. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't trust the story. I don't trust much of what I hear that comes out of Baghdad. I don't trust it at all. Ask me later specifics. I know since I did Abu Ghraib, lots of emails from lots of kids involved. It's complicated because what happens is we're going along the way the war is. It's sort of this dreary pattern. We're going along our troops and they're going down roads. It's really sort of astonishingly stupid. We patrol, which is stupid to begin with. What good does that do? They go down roads, a certain fixed road, certain times, certain places, usually in groups of 3, 4, 5 Humvees, Bradley tanks. strikers, other vehicle, heavy vehicles. One gets blown up. The Americans start screaming in pain. The other vehicles stop, run out. The soldiers are jammed into the back. You've seen some tapes or TV stuff about how they do it. They come running out and they shoot at anything that runs. And that's the war. And in one case, after I did Abu Ghraib, I got a bunch of digital pictures emailed me, and there's a lot of work on it, and I decided, well, we can talk about it later. You never know why you do things. I mean, you have some general rules, but in this case, a bunch of kids were going along, and one of them, three vehicles, one got blown up. The other two units, soldiers ran out, saw some people running, open up fire. It was a bunch of boys playing soccer. And in the digital videos, you see everybody standing around. They pull the bodies together. This is last summer. They pull the bodies together. You see the body part, the legs and boots of the Americans pulling bodies together, young kids. I don't know how old, 13, 15, I guess. And then you see soldiers dropping RPGs, which are rocket launch grenades, around them. And then they're called in as an insurgent kill. It's a kill of, you know, would-be insurgents or resistance, and it goes into the computers, and I'm sure it's briefed. Everybody remembers how My Lai was briefed as a great victory, 128 Viet Cong killed. And so you have that pattern again. You know, ask me why I didn't do the story, because I didn't think the kids did murder. I think it was another day in the war. And to even to write about it in a professional way would name names and all that. In any case, the paper also says, this is the last one of these things that I found great interest, that the Dulaimi tribe, one of the members of a major tribe in the Sunni heartland of Baghdad, the four provinces that Saddam, that are the center post of the resistance, the Dulaimi tribe probably had something to do with turning in Saddam. He had turned on some of those people. Anyway, the new defense minister is a Sunni. From the tribe, and he says he's going to continue the policies of Mr. Alawi, the former defense minister, which is what? What's the defense policies of Alawi, the former interim prime minister? Well, basically, what we've done since in the last year is we've recreated the Iraqi Mukhabarat. This is the heavy-hitting secret police that Saddam ran. We've gone in and recreated many of the members, put them through a little acid test, made them vow that their allegiance to what, I guess, to America, or they're no longer Saddamized. In any case, this is our main force right now. This is the force that Alawi controls. This is a force, the former, you know, whatever the guys, whatever you want to call them, the former roughest guys that Saddam had are now working for us. They're our most prominent security force. And we've had an amazing spectacle of the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, making at least two trips in the last 5 months. I think it's three, but I know of two. I think it was three, though. Going in and basically, once before the election was announced, and two more trips, basically pleading on the inside for the two major factions, the Kurds and the Shia. I'm assuming some knowledge of, I hope I'm not, Iraq, you know, the country, and then this country. Anyway, I don't want to kid you, but we're negotiating. Obviously, the whole point of the election was to keep Alawi in play so that he could serve as a bridge, our man, between the Kurds and the Shia. And what he delivers is, of course, is the Mukhabarat. And here you have Rumsfeld. We went to war to get rid of Saddam and all that. Here you have Rumsfeld going at least twice in the last 4 months or so to beg for Alawi to stay in, and beg basically for the former Mukhabarat security forces to continue doing what they do, terrorizing. There was an amazing piece in the New York Times Magazine. I mean, amazing, and it's inability to go beyond the immediacy of what they were reporting about one of these militias that are former Mukhabarat, former Saddam people that are now working for us, killing quote unquote insurgents, which means they're basically, I don't know, when do you describe what's going on as a civil war? I don't know, when is somebody going to say that? But if it's not a civil war, it's very close. And I don't know, I can't see an end game. I'll give you a ticket out. I think the Blair stuff is interesting. If he wants to stay as prime minister, there might be a lot of pressure on him to begin reducing troops. What I'm telling you now comes from a four-star general who was just speculating the other day in a conversation, might begin to reduce troops In the South, where the British have an enormous amount of influence and are operating in the South. Maybe that's one way out. Maybe the new Prime Minister to be Brown will do something. I don't know. That could be a way out. I don't see a way out because this president, as I've said many times, if somebody heard me speak on the radio or whatever, one of the things about this guy that's really a little overwhelming you all applaud when I come in because I do have, I do think I wear the white hat. I think I'm fighting the good fight as a journalist and trying to do what I can. And I feel virtuous. And I'm up against a president that's absolutely a nerd to me. And he's a nerd to the other good reporting. There is good reporting. It's not just me. The Washington Post has done good stuff. Knight Ridder Newspapers has done good stuff. Amy Goodman Show, Naomi Klein have done a lot of brilliant stuff about the war. It's not as if there's any monopoly on critical reporting about the war. Even in the New York Times had a marvelous story a month ago about a group of Marines that came back disillusioned, but the lack of equipment, the stupidity of their mission was an amazing story. It just went down. No stories seem to have bounce anymore, in part because, I guess, because of the networks and their cowardice, which is, I'm tired of worrying about the networks. They just are what they are. But in any case, more important than that is that this guy, this Bush, absolutely believes in what he's doing. He's not like a nervous Richard Nixon worried about, they're coming after me, or Lyndon Johnson quitting over Vietnam with great uncertainty about whether he's doing the right thing. This guy is absolutely convinced. This guy, I don't know what's in his mind. I don't know whether God talks to him or whether he's undoing what the mistakes his father made, but he is convinced that he's got to bring democracy to Iraq and then change. They've altered the plan a little bit. No, I don't think they're so big anymore into a democracy in Syria or Iran. They just want to get regime change. I think moving Wolfowitz out was a sign of sort of diminished ambitions, and it's good. I'm happy. I'm one of those people that said, yes, World Bank, yes. Then he can just, starve people, change societies, change economic structures, force everybody from any socialist program to private enterprise, but he's not killing people, and that is a plus. And so you got to applaud it. I mean, I would. Oh, wait. A Bush for Pope? I don't care. I mean, let's do it. So this guy can't be reached by us. Not just me. I mean, they can ignore me. But the networks, anytime there's a good story, not a blip. And what does that mean? That means, the body bags aren't going to stop him. This is a guy who's convinced for whatever reason that even 1,000 or another, the body count goes on. It just goes on. And of course, nobody counts the Iraqis. I love the stories. Every time you talk about Vietnam, it's always the Vietnam War is summarized this way: 58,000 American kids killed and anywhere between 2 and 3 million Vietnamese. There is a distinction between 2 and 3 million, but that's okay. I used to joke all the time. It's, racism in America is so endemic and so hard to see, but I used to joke that I was very proud of Bill Clinton because he was the first president in Kosovo, the former Yugoslavia, since World War II to actually bomb white people. It wasn't worth the trouble. It's like going after Israel, forget it. It's just, the racism is just, anyway. So you got a guy that thinks he's doing the right thing. I think he thinks in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, he'll be like Lincoln. He'll be judged as one of the great presidents. You have to understand something about presidents. They war. Jack Kennedy once, I think, is it David Donald Duncan? Yeah, the Lincoln scholar. He once said to Duncan, the Harvard historian, he once said to him that no president can be great without a war. This is early in the Vietnam War. This is in 62, obviously, he died a year later. But I think presidents like Bush understand that how important war is, even a vague reading of history. And Bush is far from an intellectual. I know I have a friend who was a major player who went to Iraq recently. There's been a series, unreported, of series of missions in Iraq that have all been there to study the war, where are we, and they've all come back pretty negatively. This guy came back and he saw the president. months ago, and he said, Mr. President, we're losing the war in Iraq. And there was a sort of a 3-second beat, and Bush said, you mean we're not winning? And this guy said, hey, I told him what I had to say. If he wants to turn it the way he wants to, that's the way it goes, you know. So he hears what he hears. And so when you inoculate it like that, and presidents always are, but war is important to presidents, which means that instinctively, heuristically, I can tell you this president's totally immersed in the war. We can't see it. I can't prove it. I've come close with somebody on the inside, but this person hasn't gone belly up yet. But anyway, by that I mean he's listening to the war, he's watching the war, he's getting daily reports. There's something called the Fusion Center that came off the prison system, and he was getting reports from that. And there were people in the White House with direct connection to the war, not known, military officer, one particular, who could get to the president for between 2003 and 2004 at any time. And so I think the notion that he's disconnected is wrong. He is strange in one way. Wolfowitz, who's if not smart, would understand this, but Bush is truly a Trotskyite, a believer in permanent revolution. We've never had one as a president before. He wouldn't understand that, but Wolfowitz would. He truly is. And and he's doing it, what he thinks he has to do, the revolutions he has to create, without any information, without an ability to absorb information that's counter to what he wants to hear. And so I don't know where you are when you have a man with as much power as he controls and a much ability to do something. I don't know how we can get at him. We can all work hard in the next election and try, forget the party, just go find good candidates and support him. I mean the Democratic Party, because I don't know. When you have a devalued opposition party, you have a devalued Congress. On any given day, I can't decide whether the U.S. Senate is supine or prone on any given day. I think Bolton will probably get through, and the critical vote on the nuclear option, of course, is probably going to be John Warner of Virginia, I'm told. He's the guy who promised to investigate Abu Ghraib, and he does investigate it. Every time another report comes out, he has a hearing, and the officers who write the report come and they testify about their report, and everybody agrees that the report they're talking about is the one they've written, and that's the extent of the investigation. Imagine this. Just alone on what we have in the Abu Ghraib, there's no serious investigation. The renditions, which is a three-syllable word to describe a process that really is very simple. It still goes on, by the way. We send people in undercover, mostly military guys, not approved, no CIA stuff, because if you do the CIA route, you have to have a formal presidential finding under the law, and you have to tell Congress. So you stick this stuff in the military. Bunch of guys go in sterile with no IDs. They go into a country, you know, they get together, they go to some village, they go to some house, they grab some guy by the hair, they drag him to an airport where they have a private plane, they fly him somewhere where the sun don't shine, they torture them and sometimes kill him. And that's called rendition. It's been going on. It's another word that we used a couple decades ago for Argentina and Brazil was disappearing people.
And that is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, giving the keynote address last night at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. When we come back, Seymour Hersh joins us live in the studio. Stay with us. وما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on NPR stations, on public access TV stations and PBS stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org and are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, we are broadcasting from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign Studios, NPR and PBS Studios, Will TV and Will Public Radio. We are joined right now by Seymour Hersh. It's very good to have you with us. Very interesting to listen to this speech.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off with, is it true that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld attempted to break into your home?
Well, no, not literally, of course, but it is true that they asked the FBI to in 1975 when I was a reporter in Washington for the New York Times. I'd written a story about, some secret stuff involving the Navy and spying in Russia and intercepts. It was pretty sensitive stuff. It was given to me by people inside the bureaucracy who thought it was stupid, counterproductive, and wasteful and dangerous. So there was a reason to write it. I mean, it wasn't as if I was just exposing something. It had been a source of enormous dismay inside that we continued to do these kind of provocative operations. This was at the end of the Vietnam War. And so they got upset. Cheney and they were both, one was chief of staff, one was his deputy, or maybe Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense then. And what happened is that during the 2000 campaign, when Cheney was nominated, a bunch of reporters from Newsweek went to the Ford Library in Michigan, Gerald Ford, Grand Rapids, I think.
Yes.
It was. There's a library there, and they discovered they had declassified some documents, sort of a 25-year time period, and out popped this file on me. And those guys at Newsweek were very excited about it. They even shared it with me. They sent me a copy. It was about 50 pages of worrying about what to do, and at one point they did ask the Rumsfeld, or Cheney was writing notes, Rumsfeld was involved and others were too, in the White House, the White House counsel, et cetera, and people from the Pentagon. And they asked the FBI to go into my house, as one of the options was go into my house. There were a series of options. One was do nothing, one was to ask the New York Times to try and do something about me, you know, to shut me down. But the most dramatic one was to go into my house, and they sent it over. And then Ed Levy, who was also a participant in these discussions, he was then the Attorney General. And as I said last night here, if we had an Attorney General like that again, former dean at the University of Chicago Law School, an eminent jurist, and he wrote him a smashing memo saying, "Are you guys, excuse me, guys, the White House cannot order the FBI to go into someone's house. We have to begin a criminal investigation. It has to be determined by appropriate judicial figures, people in the Justice Department. Department of Justice have to decide there's a case there, and then as part of the investigation, we can authorize it, you cannot." And so they were sort of rebuked, and it was in writing. Newsweek never did the story, and so...
Why?
do I know why anybody doesn't do anything? I don't know why. It never really became a story, and it was sort of, you know... this came up because somebody asked me about it last night. I decided not to write about it and talk about it. Hmm.
And what would they have found if they broke into your house?
A dog, a cat, as if somebody would keep memos and, I don't keep anything around, period. I just don't do it.
This latest news that we get out of Jordan right now about the pardoning of Ahmed Chalabi, King Abdullah of Jordan, agreeing to pardon the one-time CIA asset. For years, he faced a 22-year prison sentence in Jordan for fraud after his Petra Bank collapsed with more than $300 million in missing deposits. The Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, asking the king to do this. What's going on here and the significance?
I'm sort of glad and not glad you asked me that question because I do know something about it. Here's what I know about that. I know that King Jordan comes to visit America quite a bit, the United States. And the president likes him, our president, George Bush, because he speaks good English. He went to a prep school here in America and he's very pro-Western. And he sees the president and he has told friends about, this is about 9 months ago. He was stunned. He was seeing the president. The president said, you know, your whatever he calls him, I have a favor. And he said, of course, anything. I want you to pardon Chalabi. And he was stunned because, you know, how can he pardon Chalabi after what he'd done? The money he stole was from old women and children, you know, little funds. And he was reviled, Chalabi. I've actually read, somebody in the intelligence community once gave me the transcript of his trial in Arabic, and we had it translated at the New Yorker. Boy, this time he was sort of out of vogue, and a story never emerged out of it, but the trial was devastating. I mean, they had him nailed, and he was smuggled out of the country. He probably was in cahoots, by the way, with various members of the royal family then during this stuff, you know, bribery, etc. And in any case, he was stunned, and he didn't know what to say. He went back, and he asked people in the parliament who said, are you kidding? So all I can tell you is that Abdullah is doing what the president of the United States, to his amazing shock, because this was after the stuff came out about Chalabi and his connection to Iran. This is probably a neocon, a neoconservative play. And I guess if you wanted to extrapolate it, I don't know whether if anybody cares, but I'm sure the White House would deny it and say it's not true, but I can categorically tell you this is Abdullah's story. This I do know. And he was stunned, and he couldn't do it then, so obviously he thought time had passed. The idea that the president, after Chalabi, was in big trouble over his connections to Iran and being accused of leaking information, whether rightly or not.
Remind our viewers and listeners, they raided his home in Iraq, the U.S. forces.
Yeah, and they claimed that he had been relaying information about American intercept capability, our signals intelligence, to the Iranians, who are clearly a presence. You know, Abdullah is one of those people, along with
the King of Jordan.
Yes, the King of Jordan, along with, of course, the Saudis and the Egyptians, who see what's going on in Iraq right now as an existential threat in this sense, that they believe if the United States is making a terrible mistake by letting much of Iraq fall into the hands of what they consider to be Iranian Shia, they see the Iranian influence spreading south. And for the Sunni, those are Sunni countries, that's a devastating effect that hasn't happened before. So it's a huge issue. And then to pardon Chalabi is just, it's a personal favor for the president. I don't know what's in his mind. I do know the president, all of us understand he's more attuned. He wouldn't have done what he did in Iraq if hadn't been more attuned even before becoming president to the idea that all things in the Middle East revolve around Iraq, as the neocons always believed.
The news of this Operation Matador that is taking place right now, U.S. forces carrying it out, one of the largest post-Saddam military operations in Iraq, the U.S. admitting it's facing fierce resistance. What is the significance of this? When do casualties count? When don't they?
They're not counting now. American casualties are discounted in the newspapers. We've had an awful lot of people, more than a dozen, die in the last few days alone in Iraq. American casualties are back up. And it's not a major story. Once in a while, it gets to be a story. And so they do their own sort of accounting. The one way they balance the bad news is they have raids. And we suddenly show us on the offensive. And part of it is what the information, you know, it's an operation, it's a public relations, it's strategic deception in a way. I'm not suggesting the raids aren't there. I'm not suggesting they may even be finding people. God knows who they find. But clearly one reason they're being emphasized is to detract from what's going on, which is a steady increase in the insurgency and the resistance. And what happened is, after the election of January 30th, the election is so widely hailed by this president and the government, which, as we now know, has had very little consequence on the reality or what's going on in the ground as we move towards an open civil war there. But after the election, there were orders put out to change the reporting requirements on incidents. And in other words, you had to have a serious American fatality or casualty, not necessarily death, but a serious incident to get reported. So just a mine going off and somebody being lightly wounded wouldn't get reported. So the numbers went down right away, suggesting that somehow the election had worked. And again, if you remember before the election, there was nothing but talk from the White House about how the resistance and the resistance was going to challenge us repeatedly and go after us on election day. How do they know? I mean, we know nothing about what the resistance does. We have no intelligence about who they are, where they are. We have some ideas. We know they used to operate in three-man cells in 2003, then 15-man cells last year. We don't know when they're going to hit, where they're going to hit. So how do we know what they were planning to do before January 30th last year? We don't. But we create an image that they were planning massive attacks, and when they didn't come off, there were the usual daily assortment of attacks. It's a victory. I mean, the information is totally controlled by the American government. I don't fault the press in Baghdad because they can't get out and they can't do it. They're stuck.
Civil war?
Why not? What is it? Where do you think we're at? There was a piece in the New York Times a week ago Sunday in the magazine section. I would say one of the most stunningly obtuse, I don't know what they're thinking in my old newspaper, a piece essentially praising the fact that we have the United States is supporting a paramilitary group.
This is the cover of the magazine, the Salvadorization
right.
of Iraq.
And as you mentioned in your talk last night, with one of the American commanders who was involving and supporting and aiding the El Salvadorian hunter-killer teams back two decades ago in charge, being the advisor to this group. This is a group that, in the New York Times story, committed significant violations of the Geneva Convention, and it's almost being praised by it. There isn't a sense in the article, there isn't any sense of the big picture, that these are violations of the Geneva Convention, that this is the former Mukhabarat, the former secret police of Saddam. These are the people that we went to war against, and we're now writing articles in favor of them. The New York Times reporter was embedded with them. Although I must say, to his credit, that is acknowledged in the story, is explained, but it doesn't really explain what that means, the context. And I can say, because I have a lot of respect for the New York Times, I don't know what the guys in the top, I mean, I know when I worked there, if I wrote a magazine piece, the senior editors read it, discussed it, gave me notes. It's not just done in the magazine. The guys that run the newspaper read it. What were they thinking of?
And what about this issue of the Salvadorization, the idea that John Negroponte has been the U.S. ambassador, of course, he's head of national intelligence now, formerly in the early 80s, ambassador to Honduras, the staging ground for the Contra War. You see a connection between the people that are being brought in now, who worked Salvador two decades ago working with paramilitaries.
I don't want to beat my breast, but I think I used the notion that it's an El Salvadorian war in an article in the New Yorker about 6 months ago, saying it's gone El Salvador. And Negroponte's a true believer. He really supports this administration, Bush. He's totally on the team. Somebody said to me when he was named head of the overall intelligence apparatus by Bush, we all joke that everybody who goes to the White House has to drink the Kool-Aid in order to get there. In other words, you only want to hear from people who believe what you're saying. There's no dissent allowed. I mean, there's just no dissent allowed inside. Any dissent is not just honest dissent, it's being a traitor. And somebody said to me, well, he's going to mix the Kool-Aid. That's his job now as head of intelligence. He's very nice, a very pleasant man. He's very articulate. And I think what he's done in terms of setting up a covert, off-the-books apparatus and a killer hunter-killer teams, that's what we have now. We're taking down. The idea is, I think it's ungodly in a way, really, what he's done. The idea is, right now in Iraq, the goal they have now is they want to go into the various major cities in the Sunni heartland, the four provinces of Iraq that are considered to be pro-Saddam or pro-Ba'athist, in which, 40% of the population reside around Baghdad. The idea is to go to major cities. They did Fallujah. They're doing Ramadi right now. Take it down. Make the people of the Sunni heartland more afraid of the American / Iraqi Mukhabarat than they are of the resistance. That's the idea. And Abizaid, so I've been told, has made it clear that he thinks he can, within a year, he can take down four or five of the major strongholds. And I think the plan is to go from Ramadi to another major city of 300,000 or 400,000 and begin the same kind of operation. No more embedded journalists, only on a rare occasion. We're not there like we were in Fallujah. We don't really know what's going on in Ramadi. It seems like it's holy hell there, but we don't know. And I think that's the game plan. It's sort of a desperate game plan. It's not going to work, obviously. Occupiers, terror, and these techniques don't work. You know, the Israelis, you could argue, did well.
We have 10 seconds.
Well, with the Palestinians, because it was an existential threat for the Israelis. They learned the language, they got there. It's not for us. We're just in there dabbling. We're dabbling at this macabre, this kind of stuff. We're just causing chaos, and we can walk away.
We want to thank you very much, Seymour Hersh, for being with us, author of Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib, and that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Cadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. Thanks to all the folks at WILL. I'm Amy Goodman in Champaign, Urbana. Thanks for joining us.